This is a joint committee meeting of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, Human Services Subcommittee, the Public Safety Subcommittee, the Senate Judiciary Committee, and the House Judiciary Committee. The purpose of these informational hearings over the next 3 days is to provide all of us with an overview of the public safety system and how the various components and agencies are linked with each other. The subcommittees from last year found this a very useful exercise in their later agency presentations and work sessions. The presentations this afternoon will take the full two hours, and I would like to suggest that in order to best manage our time, that members hold your questions, write them down, and we will find the proper moment to engage with our presenters and panelists in order to get responses to your questions and comments. I would remind us all that we will have a third day with all of our participants, a third day where we will have more time to engage your questions and comments. So I'd ask you to take that into consideration as well. I'd like to thank Ms. Marla Ray, who is about to open, and all of the staff who have worked with her in a very thoughtful way, in a very deliberate and creative way, in bringing the presentations that you're about to hear forward. And so, are there any questions or comments for the good of the order before we begin? Thank you all for being here on time. And Ms. Ray, please go forward.
Thank you, Chair Gordley, Chairs Richardson, Krieger, Vice Chairs, and members of the House and Senate Judiciary Committees, as well as the Ways and Means Subcommittees on Public Safety and Human Services. My name is Marla Ray. I used to be somebody. That was a laugh line. It's okay. We can kind of warm up here. I'm now mostly a volunteer, including your volunteer air traffic controller for the next 3 days. You will hear from career professionals inside Oregon's public safety system. And as Chair Gordley mentioned, our goal is to not necessarily get into the intimate details of state agency budgets, but to give you an overview of the public safety system, its components, and how they are all pretty much interrelated. We often use the example of the balloon. When you push on one edge of it, the water kind of pops out in another area, and you see the effect of a change here and an attendant change perhaps further down on the other end of the balloon. It's also, as we learned last legislative session 2 years ago, incredibly beneficial to have this unique joint meeting so that the substantive committees and the budget committees have an opportunity to really cross-fertilize and know that the changes that may be made upstairs have a direct budget impact on the work of the Ways and Means Committee down here on the first floor. So you'll hear repeatedly for the next 3 days that interrelationship, and that really will be one of our goals and our primary focus. In a few moments, you'll hear a script on the adult side. We'll follow our fictitious Chris through the system today in a pretty illustrative way of the different components of the criminal justice system. As we go through these presentations for the next couple of days, we'll be focused on really six questions. Each of those elements of the public safety system is prepared to inform you, one, of who we are, what we do, who we affect, the funding sources, state, local, public, private, the cost drivers that may be apparent, and then the areas of discretion, to the extent there are areas of discretion. as I mentioned, will focus on more the criminal law system than the civil law system. Moreover, our focus will not be on individual agencies, but overall. Chair Gordley mentioned to you the first day's agenda today will go through the adult criminal and juvenile justice systems, public safety system overview, the community safety and law enforcement, court processes, adult and juvenile corrections, prevention and intervention. Tomorrow on day two, we'll really focus on, again, we'll follow Chris and his family in another skit. We'll discuss investigation, assessment, and case management, representation and advocacy, as well as prevention and intervention. Our third day will be focused very much on the impacts of policy changes and budget priorities. We'll have with you one of those if-then discussions. If you make this change, then this happens. If you fund this entity at this level, then these are the consequences. So we'll have a, I think, hopefully a pretty interactive, lively panel discussion for you at that time. The public safety agencies at the state level, for those of you on Ways and Means, you will have at least 16 different state budgets to look at over time. I won't read those to you. The public safety agencies, pretty well known. Judicial branch agencies are listed, as well as the human services agencies that you'll delve into. At this point, we'd like to get straight into the overview of the adult criminal justice system. We are particularly pleased to have back with us again this year for an encore performance, Doug Harkleroad and Ross Shepard. It is particularly fitting as we discuss interrelationships and cooperative working relationships within the entire system that these two professionals are the first two to begin us out. Doug Harkleroad has been the district attorney in Lane County for some 20 years in the DA's office for 30 years, minus the last few months or so. Ross has been the Lane County Public Defender for the last 20 years. He's now in Washington, D.C. But these two individuals have worked very, very closely throughout their professional careers in Lane County. And I think it's a model relationship that could and should be emulated throughout this state to have the prosecution and the defense work so closely together. So with that, Doug Harkleroad and Ross Shepard.
And as they're coming up, members, I would just check in again to find out if we're all on the same page. Anyone have any questions or comments about what we're doing, what we're about to do? Okay. Thank you.
Great. Ladies and gentlemen, legislators and others, this presentation is brought to you by the Shepard Players. That's Ross Shepard and Doug Harkleroad. The creators, producers, and directors are Ross and myself. We are solely responsible for the content of this dramatic production. 2 years ago, I said, in all likelihood, it will never be repeated. I was wrong. We're back. However, I was right when I said it would not be sold commercially. The players have been typecast and actually perform their respective functions in the real world, except for the defendant, call him Chris, who is really an assistant public defender. Without further ado, I give you that talented, my friend, the exciting, and the oldest rugby player in North America, Ross Shepard.
Good afternoon. I am Ross Shepard. This presentation depicts a typical criminal defendant as he moves through the complex criminal justice system in Oregon. The comments by the individual actors have been shortened considerably in the interest of your time and today's limitations. And I would like to now introduce, in order of appearance during this little drama, the Shepard Players. Walt Myers.
May I interrupt just for a moment? We need you to speak loudly, clearly, and into the microphone.
I will do that. Senator, there will be some speaking from the players here, and I hope that the system is strong enough to pick that up.
One of these
I introduce Walt Myers, Kathy Jordan, Senator Karsten Rasmussen, former senator, and now judge, Circuit Judge Karsten Rasmussen. Chris Hansen, who is playing the defendant today. Robert Ralph, Debbie Brokaw, Greg Hazarbedian, Karen Wheeler, Troy Bowser, and Ron Chase. The defendant, and we will call Chris today, is 25 years old.
It's been a tough 25 years.
An old felony conviction and also a conviction for car theft. Chris comes from a broken home, as so many defendants in the criminal justice system do. He did not complete high school. He has used various kinds of illegal drugs since he was 14 years old. He's only able to do odd jobs, and he is mentally ill and at times believes that cameras are everywhere and that he's being watched. So the story begins on a typical rainy afternoon in Oregon with a police officer, and we'll call him Walt, contacting an assistant district attorney, and let's call her Kathy.
I need a search warrant.
Well, let's take a look. You've got probable cause. Let's take it to the judge.
You have probable cause, and so a search warrant will be issued. Knock, knock, knock. Police, police, I have a warrant.
Who's there?
The police, I have a search warrant.
What?
Search warrant, open the door, it's the police.
Oh, okay, come on in.
Thank you. What do you have in your pocket there?
What, this?
Yes.
Nothing.
Can I see it? Looks like methamphetamine.
Hey. I don't know where that came from.
Stop using your brother's pants.
Could be. Could be.
Get around here. Put your hands behind your back. Okay.
All right, Chris, come around. Let me take the cuffs off. Put your hands down your side.
What's going on?
Turn around, face me. Mm-hmm. Put your shirt on. You're booked into jail.
Oh, not again.
I think this is methamphetamine. Could you test it, please?
It tested positive for methamphetamine.
Thank you very much. We have methamphetamine as a result of the warrant. Let's charge Chris. Turn the warrant to the judge. We found methamphetamine. Tested positive in the analysis.
Okay. All right, Chris. I'm going to go ahead and release you to jail overcrowding. I'm going to give you court dates. I promise you'll show up, right?
Oh.
Okay. Go ahead and
get your details. All right. Thank you, officer.
We found methamphetamine. Let's charge Chris.
Let's charge him with unlawful possession of a controlled substance, substantial quantity.
Now is the time set for the arraignment of Chris. Mr. Hazarbedian, where is your client?
I'm afraid, Your Honor, that he's not with us today.
Well, then I'll issue a bench warrant for his arrest and set security in the amount of $20,000.
Hi, Chris.
Hi.
You're under arrest. Get your hands behind your back.
Okay.
Okay.
All right, Chris, scalloped potatoes, not your favorite. Well, go ahead and put this shirt on. You're booked back in jail.
All right.
Didn't say so. Now is the time set for the arraignment of Chris.
Your Honor, my client enters a plea of not guilty and would request the matter be set for trial.
During the next 35 days, the public defender that has been appointed to represent Chris will do investigation as is necessary, will obtain all of the police reports from the prosecution, and will negotiate a resolution of the case with the district attorney that's been assigned to that individual case.
Madam Prosecutor, do you think we could settle this case?
Well, I'll tell you. The testing by the crime lab shows a substantial quantity of methamphetamine. If the defendant pleads guilty, I'll recommend 3 years of probation, 90 days of jail, drug and alcohol treatment, and mental health evaluation, plus the usual costs, fines, and assessments.
I've already spoken to my client. He'll accept that outcome.
You accept that outcome?
Yes.
Now it's the time for sentencing of State versus Chris. Mr. Azarbedian?
Your Honor, pursuant to negotiations, my client will plead guilty. The state will recommend 3 years probation, 90 days in jail, drug, alcohol, and mental health treatment, and the usual fines, costs, and assessments.
That's correct.
Guilty plea is accepted, and the sentence recommended is imposed.
As the one of the conditions of Chris's probation, he does serve most of the 90 days in the local jail and then is released. Chris is then directed to report to his probation officer.
Take this. Thank you.
That's county property.
Probation officer.
You are on probation for 3 years from the date of your sentence. As conditions of your probation, you must report to me monthly. You may not drink or use drugs. You must enroll in alcohol, drug, and mental health treatment and commit no new crimes.
I can do.
You must search for a job, and I can help you with that. You must meet with the treatment person this week.
Chris, who is now out of custody, reports for drug mental health treatment.
Hi, Chris.
Hi.
Nice to see you.
Hi. Can you help me?
We will sure try.
Good.
First thing we need to do is set up an appointment for an assessment, a drug and alcohol assessment. We can also take care of your mental health needs in this program, too. Let me check and see how long our wait list is. Let's see. It looks like we can get you in within about 5 weeks.
5 weeks?
5 weeks. So up until then, we need you to check in weekly for a treatment orientation group. And in the meantime, we're going to be really working closely with your PO. We need to take urine samples. And then after your assessment, we can start your course of treatment. You'll get a treatment plan, and you'll either be with us, or you might be referred to residential treatment, because we don't do that here. Before you leave today, I need you to sign some forms. I've got a HIPAA privacy form. I've got a release form for your PO, your probation officer, and your primary care doctor. I need you to sign releases to all those people today, and I need a UA sample today as well for a basement.
Where am I going to stay? Never mind. I'll do these things.
So, 6 months have now gone by, and Chris has discontinued his drug and mental health treatment program. He's failed to pay the monthly supervision fee, and he's failed to remain in contact with his probation officer.
Chris has absconded. Here's a probation violation report.
Thank you. I'll file a show cause document and ask the court to issue a bench warrant for the arrest of Chris.
The warrant for the arrest of Chris is authorized security settlement amount of $20,000.
Chris, I've got an arrest warrant for you for probation violation. Put your hands behind your back. Come with me, please.
Welcome back, Chris. Well, nice to meet you. Warmed up, ready to go.
Thank you, sir.
Back in.
Thank you, sir. Scallop potatoes?
Tomorrow, sir.
Yeah. Chris will now reappear before Judge Rasmussen with his appointed defender and with the assistant district attorney.
Now is the time set for Chris to show cause why his probation should not be revoked and sentence imposed.
Your Honor, Chris admits that he violated his probation, and we are ready to proceed with sentencing.
Chris is sentenced to a guideline sentence of 15 months in prison and 18 months of post-prison supervision.
Local jailer now takes Chris and turns him over to the Department of Corrections where he will serve a penitentiary sentence.
This is Chris, he's sent 15 months state time.
Welcome to the Oregon Department of Corrections, Chris. Is that on for me? For the next 15 months, you will go through the Oregon Department of Corrections, and the Oregon Accountability Model will guide you every step of the way from intake to the completion of your post-prison supervision. First, you'll go through a 3-week assessment, and that will tell us and help us measure your criminal risk factors.
then you'll get an incarceration plan. It will tell us what classes and treatment you need and help us place you in the right prison. At the end of your sentence, we expect you to successfully develop the skills necessary to successfully transition back out to the community and your family. It won't be easy, Chris, but we're going to help you along the way, and really, the choice is up to you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Chris is now in prison, and he has turned out to be a model prisoner. He's given 3 months of good time off of his 15-month sentence and is released to a halfway house after 12 months. His conditions of post-prison supervision during the following 18 months are that he not drink alcohol, not use drugs, and participate in the mental health program, not commit any new crimes.
Okay. Thank you for your help.
Welcome to Sponsors Incorporated, Chris. Over the next couple of months, we're going to help you find employment. You'll be expected to keep that job, stay clean, refrain from the use of alcohol and drugs, and stay in compliance with all of your release requirements. When you've completed the program, we will help you find some affordable housing out in the community with the money that you've saved by working while you're in the program. Now, I would like you to report to your treatment provider, who will begin your treatment program.
Thank you, Mr. Chase.
Good to see you again.
We meet again.
Yeah, glad you're out. Glad you got drug-free housing, too. Yeah. That's great.
That's good.
We're going to work really closely with your PO, drug-free housing, any other support people that you have working with you. Again, we've got your assessment from before, so we don't need to do that again. We just can update that. I can get you in next Tuesday this time. Our wait list has improved a little bit, and we can see you next week. I do need a baseline UA sample again today, so need the bottle there. And welcome back. Glad to have you back.
18 months passes, and we're now near the end of the story, and it could have two different endings. And it could be that Chris now has a job, is drug and alcohol free, and is a productive member of society. Mm-hmm. Or it could be, as turns out too frequently, Chris has violated the conditions of his post-prison supervision, is returned to a local jail, is prosecuted for a new crime, and ends up back in the penitentiary. Thank you.
The Ship Road players may file out quickly and quietly.
Before they do, could you all hold your signs up so that we can actually see them, the labels and the costs? Thank you.
Wow.
Thank you, players. Wow. You're gone.
All right, give them a round.
Now's my opportunity and Ross's opportunity to make just a few short observations with our combined total of about 60 years in working in the criminal justice system. Ross?
Well, the purpose of this civil endeavor and what we'd like you to take away from this skit are some of the these brief observations. The combinations of the justice components are funded from a variety of sources, as you saw, some local, some state, some a hybrid, and they're not easily understood.
It's also critical that each of the components that you saw here today in the criminal justice system be adequately staffed and funded. For example, if there is no prosecutor or public defender, the whole process breaks down. If there is insufficient jail space, as we saw in the skit, the process breaks down when Chris fails to appear in court. If there is no crime lab test of that white powder, so we know it's a controlled substance, then the case is not filed, or it is dismissed as it comes on for trial.
You will note, I think, that if prevention efforts or early intervention had worked for Chris, then he never would have entered this very expensive, complex criminal justice system.
In our opinion, the criminal justice system is the dumping ground for many of society's ills. The mentally ill end up in the criminal justice system over and over again, when what they really needed was adequate treatment for their mental illness. If we had no drug or alcohol abuse, crime would drop dramatically. We should treat drug and alcohol abuse proactively rather than as a reaction to criminal conduct. The criminal justice process will never stop domestic violence by itself. The treatment components are critical. In the criminal justice system, we act after the offense has occurred, not before.
I understand that public defense is a contentious issue, and I would like to report to you from a national perspective this afternoon. It is perhaps a universally held thought that Oregon's public defense system is well administered, is cost efficient, it provides competent legal representation for those citizens accused of crimes, affords a fair hearing, and thankfully a result of all that is that Oregon is not going through the tragedies that so many states are, where it has been found after the fact that that innocent people have in fact been wrongly convicted. And that is that is not an occurrence in Oregon, and I think that we should all together be thankful that what has been crafted in this state is an appropriate method of public defense. And Doug has reminded me that maybe one of the most crucial issues that we've brought to your attention today is the repeat nature of offenders' behavior. And if we take that aside focus solely on the costs, it is a driving part of the budget issues that you have to deal with. So any efforts that you can craft and be creative to try to break this cycle of recidivism, everybody in this state will be the beneficiary.
Madam Chair, may I ask a question? Senator Cooper, thank you. Question, please. Over here. Senator, can you tell me, I see that there's a national initiative regarding recidivism and the cost that it is costing Congress and certainly states as well. Have you looked at any of those initiatives and maybe something could be in those that you could use to look at it as a model?
Well, Senator, a model that is being adapted more frequently is one that Oregon has already embraced, and that is alternative courts, drug courts or mental health courts, where a judge is trying to individually touch and affect a defendant's life. And once again, I would applaud our county, Lane County, for being very progressive in that regard, and our state. I think also that reentry programs are also being looked at quite closely all over the country, because the numbers of people now leaving prison and coming back to society are staggering, measuring in the hundreds of thousands. So any programs that the Department of Corrections could institute that would ease that rather dramatic and probably traumatic entry back into society would serve us well.
Thank you.
Two last comments and we're done.
Please.
At the last minute, we needed a stand-in for our probation officer, and we neglected to introduce her earlier. We didn't have her in the script. It's one of your staff members, Heidi. I wanted you to know that your staff is quick on their feet. And then the last thing I would say is, as you listen to the rest of these presentations for the next 2 days, from all of the various components of the criminal justice process, we would like you to remember that interrelatedness that Marla mentioned early in the presentation. All of the components are very important. All of these components must be funded adequately. But I think even more importantly, all of these components must be in balance with the other components for the process to work properly. We appreciate your attention.
Thank you.
Mr. Harkle Road and Mr. Shepherd, we thank you. And Ms. Ray, if you would tell us what's happening next.
In this, excuse me, in this introduction, it's the only time I intend to sit back down just so that we can keep things moving. And for those that don't know, it's not normal that I would stand behind a witness at a legislative table and lurk. But that's the only way we're going to try to get through a lot of information in a short period of time. So we'll move now into the next component, law enforcement. Presenting that will be Salem Chief of Police Walt Myers and Marion County Sheriff Raul Ramirez.
Thank you. And again, members, if I could ask if you would just hold your questions until our two presenters have finished their presentation, and then we'll see if we can work in as many questions as possible. Please.
Madam Chair, I'm Walt Myers, and I'm the police chief from Salem, Oregon, and Sheriff Raul Ramirez is unable to attend today as he's ill. In his place, Sheriff Jack Crabtree from Yamhill County has come along. Our comments will be brief. We are the component of the criminal justice system which perhaps exercises the greatest discretion. In 2002, for example, we made 156,000 arrests. There are approximately 5,200 certified police officers in Oregon. That includes police and sheriffs and Oregon State Troopers, fish and wildlife, nearly 900 911 operators, Oregon Liquor Control Commission, and tribal police officers. A few of the things that our officers do to try to make our state and our communities safer include narcotics intervention. I mentioned that first. Depending on which community you are from, nearly all communities will tell you, their law enforcement staff will tell you, that somewhere between 60 and 80% of the crime is generated by drug abuse. Currently, in Oregon, we lead the nation in drug abuse of the drug methamphetamine. It's a particularly important drug in my view. Let me represent why I feel that way. For example, according to Eric Martin, a trainer for the state of Oregon, if you were to take a numeric value of the dopamine in the mind of a person who is eating a good meal, dopamine is what is produced in your brain that makes you feel good, to tell you you're feeling good. A good meal brings that up to a level of about 150. Morphine, a very powerful drug, brings that up to a level of about 240. Cocaine, which they used to call the king of drugs, brings your dopamine level in your brain up to a level of about 320. That is an addictive drug. Methamphetamine brings the dopamine level in your brain to over three times that level, over 1,000. The problem with that being it does cause brain damage, it kills cells, and of course it is extremely addictive by those who tamper with it. I'm not suggesting that one use will cause addiction, only that one use can cause addiction. It makes them feel so good that afterwards they feel so terrible when they come back to normalcy, that which you and I know is normalcy, that it drives them to go back again and again. If today there are about 7,000 children in the state of Oregon that are there because of foster care, experts will tell you, Jay Wersher, experts in our state will tell you that at least 40% of those children are there because of methamphetamine. Most likely the number is closer to 70%. And the narcotics enforcement efforts will tell you that we have not rescued 25% of the kids who live under the emotionally and environmentally toxic environment that is created by methamphetamine. In addition to that, we also conduct traffic enforcement. May not seem like a big thing. Nobody likes a ticket, but it's important for you to know that twice as many people are killed in our nation, twice as many people are killed in our state by careless drivers in a hurry as by all the violent criminals put together. Traffic enforcement is critical and very important. Probably somewhere near two-thirds of our felony arrests where felons with warrants, drugs, alcohol, or weapons are recovered are as a result of traffic enforcement. traffic enforcement is critical, and citations do save lives. We had 15 fatalities 1 year in Salem, focused our efforts on writing citations and dropped that number in a few years down to 4 fatalities. So it saves lives. Please encourage your police to write tickets. DUI investigations, a critical part of our traffic enforcement, still in the state of Oregon. Oregon, over 40%, close to half of those people who die on our highways, alcohol is a factor. Interagency child abuse investigations, as I mentioned, 7,000 children are currently in foster care in the state of Oregon, and the majority of them are there because of methamphetamine. We also do major crimes investigations, such as murders, SWAT teams, if someone is holding you or others hostage or has taken over a business or location. The SWAT team can come in and, believe it or not, contrary to what TV would say, can dramatically reduce the probability that anyone will be hurt, killed, or injured in any way. Gang task forces. In 1998, we had 5 gang murders in this area right here. And we've worked strong relationships with our community to help us set that back. But now we're seeing, much like Portland and up and down I-5 and throughout the state, we'll see eventually increased gang activity. It's not just a short-lived problem. It will require constant vigilance, particularly in our more populated areas, but in smaller communities as well. We also do elder abuse investigations, arson investigations. We have anti-terrorism teams. And school officers. Schools are one of the most active communities during the day, if you'll think about the number of people that are interacting one with another, and quite often their maturity rate is not high enough. So the school officers are a critical component, not to mention the crises we've seen in schools where officers are not present and deadly force comes to use amongst the students. We also do search and rescue and enforce parole and probation violations. Most of the officers in the state rely on the Oregon State Police to support their enforcement and investigative functions, particularly forensic services, law enforcement data system, fire marshals, state medical examiner's office, lottery services in the Oregon State, and statewide office of public safety and security, which is Homeland Security, as well as polygraph examinations. Many of the communities, probably the vast majority of the communities, when they have a police officer involved shooting, rely on the state to come and help with that investigation so we get objective investigation by a good, solid professional team. They also conduct sex offender registration and have a 24-hour statewide radio system. Of course, all the officers in the criminal justice system rely on the Department of Public Safety standards and training to deliver quality of training to uphold statewide professional standards. Oregon is still amongst the lowest in number of hours our officers are required to go through training. We're working on that, making considerable progress thanks to the support of the governor and the legislature, but we're still way down as far as being near the top of the heap. What does that translate to? Well, training. Resources make a huge difference. What we see around us is the states are tightening the noose on the monster methamphetamine. Washington, for example, if you are a convicted drug felon in the state of Washington, you cannot draw your federal benefits, which we call the Oregon Trail Card. Not surprisingly, you may expect that drug abusers and drug addicts who have been convicted of drug felonies move from Washington to Oregon, where they can still get those federal benefits. That's just one example. We read much about what the state of California is doing. The state of Idaho has for some years had a very intense effort against drugs. And, of course, the increase in effort and focus by those agencies does cause a migration, particularly from California and Washington, but from other states as well, to the state of Oregon, where there's perceived to be a greater opportunity to get by with drug abuse because of an overloaded system. We'll stand for questions if there are any questions. Thank you so much for your attention. Otherwise,
Senator Gwynnes, could we hear from the second presenter and then go to questions?
I don't have a question,
okay.
Madam Chair, but I have a comment because I want to take this opportunity to commend Walt Myers because he left out one important feature of what he does, and that is he's provided an incredible leadership in this community to get the entire community engaged in the war on methamphetamine. That included the business community, the neighbor to neighbors. We're just very, very pleased and proud of the work that our chief has done in this community. He started working on this issue several years ago. He has not stopped. and he's very committed. So I just want to say thank you, Walt.
Thank you, Senator Winters.
Please continue.
We'll move at this point, if we can, to the next component, and that is the system. Your presenters include Peter Ozan from the Office of Public Defense Services, the Honorable Carson Rasmussen, Lane County Circuit Judge and President of the Oregon Circuit Judges Association, as well as Mary Williams, Solicitor General for the State of Oregon with the Department of Justice.
Tobacco. Where are you?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Carson Rasmussen, Circuit Court Judge, 2nd Judicial District, which is Lane County, and I've been given the task today of speaking for everybody on this little miniature panel here. That was apparently an agreement made without consulting with me, which is unlike most of the agreements that are made with me generally, so I guess we'll just bear with that for purposes of today. Let me begin by pointing out that the slide that you have talks about a court process. It does not talk about courts. It talks about a court process. We are here talking about the system, the criminal justice system, and how it works with a number of different players whose roles are, of course, very different. The court's role is to be the adjudicator of disputes brought before it. A defense lawyer's role is to defend a criminally accused individual, and the state's role is to prosecute that individual. And so throughout here, while it may talk about we prosecute or we defend, there are, in fact, different roles here, which we have lumped together for purposes of this discussion. The courts themselves, by way of a brief overview, are made up in Oregon of the Supreme Court, which is the highest appellate court of the state, which has 7 members, the Court of Appeals, which has 10 members, one vacancy currently, and then the 27 judicial districts and 169 trial court judges, which are the circuit bench of the state. There are roughly somewhere in the neighborhood of 655,000 filings annually, both civil and criminal, in the circuit courts. Also involved in the criminal justice discussion here, of course, are the local courts, municipal courts, justice courts typically, where violations and some misdemeanors are also filed and also prosecuted by city prosecutors and defended by contract lawyers typically paid for by the cities. The attorneys general and assistant attorneys general also obviously a part of this system along with the local district attorneys, the state public defenders, and the local public defenders and individual contractors. That varies from county to county. Some counties have a public defender. Greg Azubedian was here earlier. He's the Lane County public defender, has a number of lawyers working in his office. And then there are also contract lawyers who are appointed cases when the conflicts exist, for example, in Lane County. I'm moving on to what we do. Obviously, we resolve disputes brought to the court. There were approximately 36,500 felony filings in 2003, approximately 69,000 misdemeanor filings, and 327,000 violation filings. My understanding is, incidentally, that these numbers do not include juvenile petitions. Local municipal and justice courts resolve, as I mentioned earlier, a number of filings. I don't have those numbers, but I would point out that in all of those cases, those are courts which are not courts of record, which means they do not create a record for review, and so their review is de novo, meaning from the beginning to circuit court if someone is dissatisfied, or particularly if a defendant is dissatisfied with the outcome, they have the right to appeal upon payment of a filing fee to circuit court where the case is tried all over again. The court process, going on to the next slide, provides both a trial and an appellate court process. I would point out, just for your information, that while I know from my experience much of the focus in Salem is on appellate courts and appellate court decisions, something in the neighborhood of 1% of all decisions and filings in Lane County Circuit Court are appealed. Excuse me, 1%. And I think the number I came up with in a study of approximately 3 years 98, 99, and 2000 was that three one hundredths of 1% of cases appealed, of all cases filed, excuse me, result in a reversal. So the bulk of the work that you implement or that you hear about in the trial courts of this state is done at the circuit court or the municipal court or the justice court level. It seems somewhat axiomatic to remind you, but nonetheless, obviously, a well-working criminal justice system has a profound impact on many, many people. In the skit that you saw a few moments ago, the focus really was on Chris, the defendant. And that's an appropriate focus to understand how the system works just linearly, how someone goes back and forth in the system. But I have learned from doing literally thousands and thousands of sentencings in 6 years that there are many, many profound impacts outside of that defendant's own life, namely that defendant's family, the victims involved in a crime, be they direct victims in an assault case or indirect victims because a meth addict is burglarizing or stealing. There are consequences to businesses. There are expenses to businesses. There are reflections in all of this in medical health insurance premiums and car insurance premiums, et cetera, et cetera. It's difficult to measure those costs, but from my seat on the bench, it is not difficult to see those costs because the primary problems, if you listed them 1 through 3 in the state of Oregon, are meth, meth, and meth. Pure and simple. There's no day that goes by in my working life that does not involve methamphetamine. Period. We affect, obviously, we provide a forum for victims to have a forum for victims to speak out at sentencing in the court itself. Many district attorney's offices provide a victim services office, which provides a service so that victims of crimes understand the nature of the system, because many of them have no reason to understand the system, and they need an education, unfortunately, about how it's going to work. Obviously, the point of the system is to hold offenders accountable and to provide anyone accused of a crime with a court-appointed lawyer, if they are eligible for it, to protect the rule of law and thereby to protect all of us. We handle many thousands of different kinds of cases in circuit court, and I'm giving you a flavor really for, as the chief criminal judge in Lane County, constitutes a large part of my day, but does not constitute the only thing that we do, and I just ask that you remember that when you think about the courts. Funding sources include the state general fund, local general funds, traffic fines, parking, and other assessments. I see Senator Przanski is here. Criminal fine assessment account, civil filing fees, federal nonprofit grants, indigent offender application, contribution, and recruitment programs. Just a couple of comments on that. We're working with a program now, a pilot project in Lane County regarding offender application and contributions, and we're hoping to have some information on that in the relatively near future, pretty new program, to see if there's a better way for us to handle that. The state courts are, by and large, general fund funded. 92% of our budget is general fund money, and, of course, that's different than for municipal court and justice courts. Hence my comment about my state senator. State and federal constitutional mandates obviously drive much of what we do. The obvious example to that right now that's on my radar screen, and I presume on yours, is the Blakely decision coming out of Washington, D.C., and the recent decisions that have followed, I think, Booker and Fen-Phen. And these are decisions which are going to have an impact on your state court system, as we have a differing variety of rulings at the circuit court level. Those will move to the Court of Appeals, where we hope to get some direction about how to handle those cases, whether retroactivity applies. There are just any number of questions about how that whole for lack of a better word, situation is going to be resolved. Crime rates obviously have a big effect on what we do. Statutory and ballot measure changes have a big impact on what we do. So too do demographic effects, population growth, et cetera. In Lane County, in the last year, there's been some budgetary constraints, and as a result, some changes in the district attorney's office. That has an impact on what's being charged by the district attorney's office, and hence the number of filings in the criminal world may go down, or they may go up if those positions are funded. Charging decisions, the availability of crime labs, for example, a great example would be residue cases and whether a district attorney's office is going to pursue them in light of the cost associated with proving a residue case, given the nature of the case itself. Our likelihood of success depends on so many factors that you've heard about, prison beds. In my life, jail beds is the big issue, or the lack thereof, which probably has an impact, at least in my view, on the likelihood of success of treatment. Treatment component, the funding of treatment, number of beds, et cetera, all of these have a significant impact then on our work. I think the popular metaphor these days is water and hydraulic effects, and I would certainly ask that you keep that in mind as you think about these issues in the course of the next, it was August for me, so I'm hoping earlier for you, the next 6 months, because the reality is that when you touch one part of the system, you have an impact on another part of the system invariably. Case complexity, number of death penalty cases, these are all cost drivers as well. We have some areas of discretion. These are indicated also in the slide. Charging decisions by district attorney's office, how we resolve cases at our level. We engage in Lane County in trying to resolve cases at arraignments, and I think we succeed at that quite a bit. We have a variety of docket management tools that we use to try to resolve cases, and we're pretty happy about our resolution numbers in Lane County. Different counties do it differently because, of course, some counties have 15 judges like Lane County, some have 38 like Multnomah County, and some have one or two like Baker County. So it's going to be different by county, and it ought to be different by county because we have different pressures on our resources. The primary area of discretion in your hands is the criminal code. And when you criminalize something or inflate the criminal consequences of something, it has a consequence in some way other than the black and white that you write in the code. It may result in a higher level of skill required for appointment from Mr. Lozan's budget. It may require a higher degree of skill in appeal from Ms. Williams' office. There are always consequences to these decisions. Probably under Blakely right now, the big question is how many extra jury trials will we be trying in the circuit court, and we don't know the answer to that. Because obviously the discussion of Blakely is whether the aggravating factors should be tried to a jury, and if you're going to plead not guilty and contest your innocence at trial, you may not want those aggravating factors to be presented to a jury, and so it's not clear to me how big an impact that will have, but we're going to have to work that through for a year and a half before we know. All three of us would be very happy to answer any questions that you have, and Madam Chair, thank you once again for having us here today.
Please continue.
Peter or Mary, do you have anything to add?
Thank you.
We're good.
Senator Brzezinski.
I just figured I maybe should respond to one of my constituents' concerns about one of the bills I could introduce. Let him know that I do not expect Lane County or any other county, and most of the cities, in fact, I say the vast majority of the cities in the state, will be impacted by the final result of that bill.
Thank you, Senator.
You're more than welcome.
Madam Chair,
all I can say is if Senator Brzezinski is supporting that bill, I'm absolutely in support of the bill, regardless of the august judge.
Ms. Ray, I think we better continue.
Quickly.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
We'll now move on to the adult corrections and juvenile justice systems. You'll be hearing from two gentlemen you'll all see a lot of this legislative session, for the Oregon Department of Corrections Director Max Williams and for the Oregon Youth Authority Director Bob Jester.
Yes, that'd be great. Thank you.
Former Representative Williams, it's good to see you.
Thank you very much, Madam Chairman, and members of the very long and wide committee. I hope to try to keep eye contact with all of you. Thanks. I do appreciate the opportunity to be here and you doing this presentation. I certainly found it valuable when I was on the other side of the dais, and I hope you do as well. My comments today with respect to the adult corrections system as part of the public safety system, I'll be speaking not only as the mouthpiece for the Oregon Department of Corrections, which I lead, but also on behalf of county jails, the community correction system, and the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision that will be covered in the materials that I present today. So who are we? We are county jails in adult corrections, the Oregon Department of Corrections, the community correction system, and the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision. This is your statewide system of incarceration and supervision, and you can tell it's made up of both state and county partners. What we do is county jails. We house adult offenders before trial, felony offenders sentenced to jail as part of a probation sentence, and we saw some of that occurring in the skit today as you think about where the defendant went. He spent some time in a jail before he went on to the prison environment. Felony offenders who are sentenced to a prison term of less than 1 year to be served at the county level, and that's the 1145 changes that were made back in 1996. Some felony offenders serving less than 12 months will stay at the county level, and then certain counties continue to provide supervision of those misdemeanor offenders that also land in your county jails. There are about 8,000 jail and work release beds statewide in your county jail system. At the Oregon Department of Corrections, what we do is we operate your 12 statewide prisons. We manage approximately 13,000 adult offenders. We either directly through two counties that we operate ourselves or through contract with the remaining counties manage the felony population of 30,000 offenders on probation and parole and post-prison supervision. And that additional 45,000 is the 30,000 plus 15,000 misdemeanor offenders that are managed by various counties who choose themselves, not through state-operated funds to community corrections, but through county resources to manage misdemeanor offenders. And we provide corrections-based programs and community-based sanctions through that operation. It's important, and you heard Troy Bowser, who represented the department in the skit, mention the Oregon Accountability Model. The Oregon Accountability Model is the methodology we attempt to use and the strategy we try to use to address the issue of the individual's criminality upon intake through the kind of treatment and beds and services provided. I think all of us in this audience would agree that the one thing that you saw occurring in this skit that doesn't always occur is that the defendant was able to get services generally each time he appeared to need those services. I can tell you even within our own system we have substantial need for services that we simply don't have the resources to provide. So not everyone is necessarily getting the service they need at the time that they need it during their period of incarceration and post-release. I'll now talk just briefly about the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision. It determines the conditions for offenders leaving prison. It imposes the sanctions for violations of that supervision, and it determines whether discharge from parole and supervision is compatible with public safety. The mission of the Board of Post-Prison Supervision is the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision is to work with the Department of Corrections and the local supervising authorities to protect the public and reduce the risk of repeat criminal behavior through incarceration and community supervision decisions. Who do we affect in adult corrections? Well, all Oregonians, frankly. By managing the state's most serious offenders within our system, both at the jail and at the state level, we have obvious impacts on law enforcement, on courts, and on social service agencies. And I want to try to tie that relationship just briefly to some of, again, what you saw. As the same individual moved throughout the system, you saw them touching various components of not only the public safety system, but the health and human services and social judicial systems as well. It's very challenging as we work on issues involving reentry and transition of individuals from incarceration back to the community, that we have positive and working relationships with our other state partners that are providing these services, everybody from employment to housing to DHS for welfare and health-related services. Those are the components that will ultimately help make someone successful on their transition back to the community. Adult Corrections is funded, obviously, primarily through the State General Fund with respect to the Oregon Department of Corrections and to the community supervision under the Community Corrections Act through those grant dollars. Obviously, counties also use their own local general fund to support their jail operations and some portion of their community corrections funding. Federal funds and grants are also received throughout the public safety system in varying degrees, depending on both the county and the state agency involved. They're private or not for profit grants and various public bonds and certificates of participation for new jail and obviously for prison construction. Those are done by COPs authorized by the legislature. Here's some ideas of the cost drivers involved in what we do in adult corrections. Obviously, longer sentences due to changes in statutes in the Oregon Constitution, the mandatory requirements is, such as Measure 11 and Measure 17, which require all inmates to work at least 40 hours a week or be involved in substitute programs that would substitute for work under the measure. Our inmate population growth, which is projected in this biennium to grow 7.2% and will increase by somewhere in the neighborhood from almost 13,000 inmates to almost 18,000 inmates over the next 10 years. The increasing age of inmates, we will double the number of inmates we have that are over the age of 55 probably in the next 5 years. As those ages generally increase, obviously the costs associated with health care for a population that generally, as the doctor knows, is not necessarily taking good care of themselves, continues to drive up the need both at the state and at the county level to provide the appropriate level of health care at increasing costs. We're impacted, obviously, by rising energy costs, by the labor costs, by the challenges of being able to recruit and retain appropriate and trained staff. The number of offenders on supervision, which continues to rise as you incarcerate a greater number of people. As you all know, 95% of the people who are within the system ultimately release back out into the community. And so as the number of people you incarcerate increases, so eventually does the number of people you've released back into the community and have to supervise. The assistance for offenders to become employed, to deal with those societal changes and reengage with the family and the community, and obviously the issues involving mental illness that so many of you are aware of as it relates to the impact on the criminal justice system and individuals who are developmentally disabled or sex offenders. All of those things drive costs, particularly related to supervision. And within the system, I'll just give you some sense that we have approximately 23% of our population that has a diagnosable mental illness, and about 13% have a mental illness that is either severe or acute. You'll hear very much the similar thing from people who are managing that very similar kind of dynamic in the jail setting. And the challenge that in a correctional environment to provide the right kind of services to people who are suffering from mental illness. The availability of prevention and treatment services during custody in prison in the community, and I mentioned that. I cannot comment on the issue involving recidivism. As you fail to treat someone's addiction issues and as they release out into the community and then reoffend again, the average cost just for the Department of Corrections budget is approximately $58,000 for each recidivating inmate. Over a period of 3 years, it would not be unlikely for the department to spend almost $200 million dealing with offenders who had been released within the last 3 years as they come back into the system. So it's a substantial cost, and much of that relates to the issues of treatment and prevention and the kind of services that you can provide both inside and outside under supervision. Areas of discretion. Jails have a little more discretion in their ability to matrix out than do the prisons, but essentially it's an issue of either crowding or releasing inmates when there are not sufficient jail beds or when there's insufficient resources to operate those jails. There are some alternative sanctions and interventions in lieu of incarceration. Those can include everything that you've heard from drug courts to mental health courts to other kinds of sanction approaches. For prisons, we are required to take into custody everyone whom the court remands to us, and so our ability to have much discretion does not focus on the release side. So under the budget discussion, for us, the areas of discretion are simply really crowding, shifting people to out-of-state beds if you fail to have sufficient bed space by construction. So there's really very little discretion in that area. In the community corrections area, for supervision once somebody's been released, you will get whatever supervision you can essentially afford to pay for. Most everyone recognizes that it's best practice to focus on your highest risk offenders, the people with the highest risk to reoffend, which means that you start to pay less attention to your lowest risk offenders. So as money is less available or you make these kinds of choices, you drive the line down or up depending on how much resources are available to who you want to supervise. If you drive the line too high, then there are people who you otherwise want supervising who will not have that supervision and then will likely, at least be more likely to reoffend and come back into the system. So it is that hydraulic that you've heard so much about today. Request for early termination of supervision, change in the mix of community sanctions and interventions, which we talked about, and obviously if we fail to fund community corrections at an appropriate level under 1145, counties have the option to exercise their statutory opt-out, and we had two of those counties do this in the last biennium and turn over those responsibilities to the state. That's a brief, very brief, rapid-fire rundown of the adult corrections system, and I'm now going to turn it over to my good colleague and fellow director to talk about the juvenile system.
Chairs, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Jester, and I am the director of the Oregon Youth Authority. The purpose of Oregon juvenile justice system is to protect the public and reduce juvenile delinquency. The system is funded on principles of personal responsibility, accountability, reformation within the context of public safety, restitution to victims, and the community. The system was established in 1995 through the enactment of Senate Bill 1. We truly are a juvenile justice system of partnerships. We have components in the juvenile justice system, the Oregon Juvenile Departments, who from referral through providing a continuum of local services and sanctions are very key players in the juvenile justice system, integral to the management of the population and providing the first level of intervention for youth who have been brought before the juvenile department for behaviors that would be law violations if, in fact, they were adults. The Oregon Youth Authority receives youth both from the juvenile court as well as transfers from the Department of Corrections for those youthful offenders who have been charged with Measure 11 offenses prior to their 18th birthday. And those youth offenders who have been waived to adult court. The Criminal Justice Commission provides funding to local communities for juvenile crime prevention services, a very important component in early intervention and providing the kinds of services that these young people will need to prevent further penetration into criminal justice systems. Private providers, again, these are an integral network both from foster parents as well as residential providers and social service providers that we contract with both at the state level and the local level to provide specific services to youth based on an individual case plan driven by a universal risk need assessment. And it would be remiss not to mention the integral linkage between the juvenile justice system, as Max pointed out, with the DOC system. We also have an integral linkage with Department of Human Services. And we rely on DHS for medical services, for mental health services, for alcohol and drug treatment services, for the families and for youth who are in those families of members that were serving the juvenile justice system. Faith communities are also major participants in the juvenile justice continuum, along with countless volunteers and civic organizations. What do we do in the juvenile justice system? Through evidence-based best practices, we supervise county probation youth and perform court services. We manage new juvenile referrals and probationers in communities and divert youth from state programs. We supervise and manage highest-risk youth offenders in state facilities and state contracted community programs. We provide juvenile crime prevention funds to counties to manage local prevention programs. We provide mental health, drug, alcohol, and health services to youth who are in our physical custody. And I would like to mention that in the population that we have in the youth correctional facilities across the state of Oregon, 59% are diagnosed with a mental health illness. 82% have a history of the use of drug and alcohol. So this is a group of youth who have not received the kinds of services at the right time as they have moved through adolescence, and some of their behaviors have become law violations if they were adults and they have been adjudicated in court, and oftentimes a criminal justice system therefore becomes by default a social service agency to provide the kinds of services that these youth need and require. And I think it's a very important point, because we can't advocate solely for a juvenile justice or a justice budget. We have to look at the other drivers with these youth and what brings them before us. Who we affect: victims and communities. We direct restoration of losses and provide safety in communities, notifying and informing victims of status of offenders. Victim restitution and community services, these are very highly regarded values in the juvenile justice system, both at the local and the state level. Who do we serve? The youth, by providing accountability and opportunities for reformation. And coming off of my previous comments about the alcohol and the mental health data that we have, most people who focus in the juvenile justice system want to talk about the criminality. They want to talk about the level of offense behavior and the risk to public safety that these youth have. And that's a very important component of the justice system. We need to look at public safety and how to ensure that our programs first and foremost address that. But additionally, we need to look at the social characteristics of the youth that we are managing, both at the state level and our community partners are managing every day in the communities in Oregon. As I said, 82% use drugs and alcohol, 59% again diagnosed mental health illness, 9%, almost 1 in 10, have passed suicide attempts, 48% of the youth that we are managing have a parent who has been convicted of a crime. So this is a cycle behavior that we are dealing with. 31% are victims of sexual abuse. 64% are special education eligible. 19%, 1 in 5, are already parents themselves. And 72% upon entering the system are deficient in school credits. Who we affect: law enforcement and juvenile justice stakeholders, by supporting prevention, intervention, and enforcement efforts. And again, we're talking about providing this continuum of services and sanctions, recognizing that the beginning of and ending of those services and sanctions rest in Oregon's communities. Funding sources: state general fund, obviously, local general fund. It is very important to keep in mind that our juvenile departments are funded by county revenue. Federal funds and grants: there are some additional federal funds available for youthful populations and there are for adult populations. We rely on Medicaid, BRS Title 19 funding for those services provided to eligible youth in our communities, which offsets general fund. We also have public bonds and certificates of participation. And we also have child support revenue collection and trust fund collections that we rely on. Cost drivers: changes in statutes, constitution by either legislature or ballot measures. Youth needs and risk, particularly clustered around mental health, alcohol and drug, medical and criminogenic factors. And areas of discretion: unlike the adult system. We do not have determinate sentencing for youth offenders. We do not have a parole board. Those releases are made in conjunction and collaboration with our community partners, primarily juvenile departments, with notification to the circuit courts. And those release decisions are based on a risk-need assessment. Again, we do have the discretion to place those at risk in the community. Areas of discretion, again, with the juvenile crime prevention dollars, those are managed through a juvenile crime prevention advisory committee, which makes decisions and reviews and determines grants to counties for prevention services. I, along with Max, would be happy to answer any questions that committee members may have.
Thank you, colleagues. We have about 10 minutes for questions or comments. Senator Devlin, then Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Williams, Mr. Jester, everybody that comes before Ways and Means Committee is, when you ask them this question, their usual response is, we need to have it all funded. The criminal justice system is probably more clearly a system, at least in how we treat it, than our other major areas for general fund expenditures, education and human services. If we have to set priorities within the criminal justice system, particularly within your systems, in juvenile justice, corrections, and adult corrections, would you put a higher priority on those things that might prevent people from coming into the system, or those that might prevent people that are already in the system from reoffending? And secondarily, if that's not a choice you'd like to make, would you put a higher priority on those people most likely to come into the system, or those most likely to reoffend? Obviously, the populations that you've identified in terms of people with problems within the system, we do not have adequate resources to address, nor do I anticipate we will have adequate resources to address in this coming biennium.
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, I always appreciate your thoughtful and insightful questions. Mr. Jester?
Waiting where you're
going. Yeah, right, right.
And I'm where to cut.
I appreciate this. And the Senator and I have had this conversation actually quite recently. What I would tell you is the entire system, particularly the system involving your incarceration system in the state, its primary mission is to reduce victimization. That's really what we're all about. I mean, whether it's by holding the offender accountable for their actions during the period of incarceration where they won't be able to victimize someone, or the second half of our stated public mission, which is to reduce their future likelihood of criminal activity, the purpose is to reduce future victimization because someone has already been made a victim. So we're trying to accomplish that. Now, if you had a magic wand that you could wave to say, if this program worked, there would be no more victims, that might be where you want to put your money. I think realistically, you know and I know that there has to be a balance that operates within this system that funds both the efforts at trying to prevent people from becoming victimizers and dealing with the people who have been victimizers and reducing the likelihood that they will go out once they release and create new and future victims. The way you do that, frankly, I think, in a resource-limited environment is you try to focus your resources, and all of the evidence-based practices would suggest this, that you try to focus your resources on those who have the highest likelihood to reoffend or to create new victims. So I'm not sure I can make the choice for you between do you put resources into the current population or into the people who might someday be that current population if you don't intervene. What I will tell you is that within the scope of those areas, you want to invest your resources where people are identified by best practice approaches, by criminogenic factors and assessments. You want to invest your resources in those people who you know coming in the door have the highest risk to offend when they walk back out into the community, because those are the people that you can make the difference. Now, the challenge you have is that it's also the people that people want to spend the least amount of time with. We can find volunteers both in the public area and in Bob's organization and my organization who would love to come in and spend the time with the people who are unlikely going to reoffend and go back into prison. Those are the people that everybody wants to spend some time with. The ones that are the hard cases, who are the most likely to offend when they get back out, that's the place where you have to invest your resource, and that's obviously the toughest nut to crack. So it is a challenge, but that's what I'd tell you, Senator. And I make this point. In all of these systems, whether you're talking about a county jail system or you're talking about the DOC or even the OYA system, it's hard to get those effects if you're also in a system where you're having to spend a lot of time worrying about whether or not you can run the system safely. Maslow's hierarchy tells you people are most interested in, you know, food, shelter, and their safety before you can get them to start engaging in the program and actualizing what their life might be when they get out with these kinds of opportunities that we provide them. You have to make sure that they're going to be safe in the environment. And it's tough to keep them safe in the environment when you've got them on top of each other.
Before I go to Representative Hansen, then Representative Hanna, and then Senator Westland, let me ask a question related to what was just asked. One of your areas of discretion in the adult correction system is, with regard to prisons, is to temporarily delay prison construction by increasing prison population density and renting space in non-state facilities. I'm reading directly from one of our slides. What strategies would you use to manage such a delay, were that to be the choice of the legislature?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, as almost I think all of you are aware, the department is actually asking for just the opposite of that. We're asking for the legislature to approve our ability to go forward given the 7.2% increase in population we expect in the next biennium. In the last biennium, we did delay construction and have utilized virtually all temporary and emergency beds that we are comfortable using within the current system. There's currently about 1,000 temporary and emergency beds above the budgeted bed capacity that are currently being used within the department, and we're now using rental beds throughout the state where we're contracting with counties and starting to use jail rental beds. Were the legislature to make the decision not to go forward with increasing capacity, our need to rely on those additional rental beds from jails would likely increase. My suspicion would be that over the course of the biennium that capacity would be ultimately insufficient and that we would be forced to look out of state for potential jail capacity in order to handle that. The challenge you have when you obviously string a population like this throughout a system of county jail beds and into other regions of the country is you lose the effectiveness of what programs we can offer to try to reconnect people to their family, the quality of the level of drug and alcohol treatment programs potentially being provided, and other kinds of services that you simply just don't have control over when people are scattered hither and yon. So the reality is that it ultimately has an impact on your issues, frankly, I think, involving recidivism, on your ability to achieve the kind of system that you'd like to provide, on the ability to deliver the same kinds of resources across your system of incarcerated individuals. In other words, some are getting some kind of resources and some are getting another, and there's not a consistency in that, which potentially presents legal issues that the department would, and the state at some point might have to consider. So it's a bad set of choices. We'd use the very best means we could to manage it, but I can assure you that given the decision that the legislature made last session to delay construction, we've managed through sort of the short-term local solutions in the way that we think was best possible, and we're frankly not terribly comfortable continuing to crowd within our existing institutional structures.
Appreciate your candor. Representative Hansen, then Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Relatively quick question. Mr. Williams, could you identify people within your correction system that might be good candidates to be safely released on possibly a clemency arrangement if either their physical or mental health is deteriorated to the point that they are very expensive to incarcerate and still would not represent represent a risk to the community?
It was a relatively brief question, and it will be a very brief response.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, far be it from me to suggest that Ms. Ray is wrong. I would tell you that it's a more complicated methodology. The department does currently have a system in place that can allow for a medical discharge in a very strong set of circumstances where the individual would not pose a further threat. That's limited by, for example, Measure 11, where no matter how bad a Measure 11 offender is or someone who is under a mandatory sentence, their health is never going to be a factor in us being able to release them under the current provisions. So that's not an available issue. The department has done it. It's been done rarely. And I would tell you that being the person who has to sign off on that, and from my colleagues, I hope you can appreciate sort of this change of hat that I wear, that is not a comfortable position to be in, because you don't know necessarily in every set of circumstances how safe this individual is. And so we take the issue of public safety as our number one highest priority, and we're very, very cautious about how we do that. Could we identify additional people? Yes, I think we could. Could we put a structure in place that I think could keep the public safe? Yes, I think we could. Is it something that we ought to engage the legislature in a conversation with so you all understand the risks associated with this decision? Yes, it is.
Thank you.
Representative Hanna, then Senator Westland.
Madam Chair, thank you. Gentlemen, we heard from Director Williams about how many facilities, 12 statewide facilities, and the number of folks that are either in those facilities or being kept an eye on through parole. Could you help us with the number of facilities with the Oregon Youth Authority and how many folks are incarcerated in those?
Certainly. Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, the Oregon Youth Authority operates 10 facilities statewide. These range in size from 25-bed work release camps on the coast and range up to a 345-bed McLaren Youth Correctional Facility and pretty much everything in between. We manage 2,150 offenders, of which 850 of those reside within those 10 facilities.
Representative Hanna, this is a level of detail that we'll be getting into in our public safety subcommittee. And then I would remind members of what was said at the beginning of this meeting. On the third day of this informational hearing or set of hearings, we will have the opportunity to further engage with all of the presenters. And so, again, if you can hold on to some of your questions, that will help us manage the rest of our time. We don't want to leave too little time for the area of prevention and intervention, which is coming up next. With that said, Senator Westland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two quick comments, and then a question for you. First of all, I want to underscore, not only for the benefit of the committee members, but also all those present, a point that Director Williams made with regard to a cost driver within his system and all of public safety as well as our health care side, and that is the aging demographic of our population. It's really pretty simple in some regards. There's a little blip at the beginning of life, and then the plane rises ever so gently until we get to about 55, where it starts going up at about a 45-degree angle, and then at 65 it starts going straight up. And that is certainly a cost driver for all of us to be concerned about. And it's a high, I admit, the enemy and he is us comment. There's nothing we can do with it except effectively deal with it. So I appreciate you bringing that forward, Director Williams. My second comment is that of the three familiar faces at the dais, it is exceptionally good to see two of you anyway. The those in the gray suits look particularly attractive today.
it's charcoal.
Question for you, Madam Chair. Would it be all right if I go to sleep while Marla Ray is speaking? Would that be permissible?
I wouldn't chance that if no, were I you, Senator Westland.
She's wearing a gray suit.
Thank you for your presentations, and we'll be hearing more from both of you. Thank you, Mr. Jester. And Ms. Ray, who's on first?
Our next and final presentation for this afternoon will concern prevention and intervention. Our presenters include Bob Nickel from the Department of Human Services. Bob is with the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services, and a face that may be familiar to some of you, Craig Prinz, now the Executive Director of the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission.
Before the two of you begin your presentation, there is a question that I would like for you to be thinking about, and if you could weave a response into your presentation. The Mentally Ill Offender Treatment and Crime Reduction Act passed the U.S. House and U.S. Senate and was signed into law by the President on October 30th. The bill authorizes $50 million in federal grants in each of the next 2 years for collaborative efforts between criminal justice and mental health agencies at the state and local level to improve the response to people with mental illness. And I'd like for you to share with us, this is directed to Mr. Nickel, if Oregon is participating with those grant dollars being available, and if so, please describe the efforts that are underway.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the invitation to be a part of this today. For the record, my name is Bob Nickel, and I'm the administrator for the Department of Human Services Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services. I notice our slide says addictive services, and there's probably not much difference, but just for the record, it's addiction services. Madam Chair, would you like me to respond now to the question or save that for a little bit later?
However it works in your presentation, just so long as we get a response.
Okay,
on the
well,
thank you.
Madam Chair, since it's on my mind now, I will just respond directly.
Okay.
We're aware of this. We haven't seen any of the directives that that will be coming down from the federal government. As soon as they do, we're going to be talking about whatever kind of collaborative proposal we can put together so that Oregon can participate. We will, I'm sure, apply for one of the grants, but we haven't had detailed discussions about it yet. But we are aware of it and looking for it.
Mental health awareness.
As you can see from the earlier slide, prevention and intervention really is woven, needs to be woven into the fabric of what we're involved with, both with public safety. Just a quick comment that's not part of the slides. I think that there really has been, over the last 5 years, maybe more, a recognition that mental health treatment and alcohol and drug treatment, longer than that, really does need to be a part of the public safety equation. There was a time probably 15 or 20 years ago when some of us in the mental health and addictions field, though again I think addictions has always recognized the critical involvement that they have, maybe we were less excited about being involved in this area. I think that time has changed, and I think the recognition is clearly there that this is part of what the public mental health system needs to be involved in, if not exclusively, at least a major player. So the prevention continuum slide, and I'm told is far too detailed, and I'm not going to walk you through every one of those. The concept, though, to get across here is that prevention and intervention really can be thought of as a continuum that starts with interventions that are largely preventive in nature that serve many, many people, sometimes universal prevention, which involves potentially everyone in the state, and moving on to secondary prevention, intervention and treatment, which you begin to clearly see recognizable mental health and addiction approaches like cognitive behavioral therapy and family counseling and multisystemic therapy, and a lot of words that we will probably hear now, and maybe in 10 or 15 years there will be different words, but those are the current tags. Graduated sanctions, and then finally at the end, the most restrictive and usually most expensive corrections, and I might add institutional kinds of care. We serve only about 1,500 people a year in our state hospitals, but we serve about 120,000 to 130,000 people in our mental health and addiction programs. So you can see that what happens in reality is we serve very many more people in the middle part of this continuum than in the end. And in mental health, at least, about 25% of our total budget is spent in the state hospital and the other 75% in the community systems. The next slide describes prevention and intervention, who we are. We are the Oregon Department of Human Services, but I think that's a little bit deceptive in that we at the department really don't operate, except for the state hospital, much of the service system. So we rely on county mental health and drug abuse prevention and treatment programs. We rely through often subcontract arrangements on private and nonprofit health, mental health, and addiction service providers. Craig represents now the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission. We work with tribal governments, and we work with county juvenile departments. There are many mental health and addiction services that are provided not through the budget that I have control over, but outside my budget, which are part of the state and local corrections and probation programs. We have court-connected diversion programs, such as drug courts, mental health courts, etc. We have community education programs. What we do, I think this is fairly simple. We provide a whole range of prevention and intervention services, everything from...
Can I ask a question? You mentioned drug courts and mental health courts. Do they exist in all 36 counties?
Madam Chair, Senator Winters, no, they don't exist in all. We have more drug treatment courts than we have mental health treatment courts. I believe we only have three or four mental health treatment courts in the state, but we have more in the way. But not every county has access to this.
Thank you.
Or drug courts.
Or drug courts.
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator Winters and Senator Westland, drug courts are more frequently used than mental health courts, but again, not in every county yet.
I asked that, Madam Chair, because I didn't want to leave the impression that we had it existing in all 36 counties.
Very good point.
We also have various methods for intervening in family abuse situations, probably more through the child welfare and child protective portions of the Department of Human Services. We also provide community corrections, probation, and diversion programs. We protect public and prevent youth from entering or returning to the juvenile justice system. We protect the public and prevent youth from criminal lifestyle as adults. Again, let me just say these are very high-level overviews, and I anticipate that there will be some questions, so I apologize in advance for having such a broad brush here. But who we affect? We affect all Oregonians by ensuring that families and neighborhoods are safer. We affect the public safety system directly by addressing problems before they lead to criminal conduct. And then if there is criminal conduct, we use a variety of mental health and addiction treatment approaches to try to lessen the degree of criminal recidivism. I think one of the things that we are needing to work further on but have at least gotten a start on is there are many mentally ill and addicted people who have both sets of problems. In fact, many of the studies that are nationally known show that about 90% of people who have mental illnesses who get involved with the criminal justice system are also struggling with an alcohol and drug problem. They may not be classically addicted. In other words, they may not go into withdrawal, but their mental status is dramatically impacted for the negative, and their likelihood of committing criminal acts as well as things like suicidal behavior much more dramatically increased if both problems are occurring at the same time. Our funding sources for prevention and intervention are state general fund, local general fund, beer and wine taxes, particularly for addiction services, some fee for service and payments for treatment that individuals who have the ability to do that can pay. And I think that's not always a bad idea at all for people to pay at least a portion of their treatment, particularly for addiction services. And we are increasingly reliant on federal funds, particularly Medicaid funds and also federal block grant funds for both mental health and addiction services. And finally, it's not a large amount, but we do have access at times to private and nonprofit grants and occasionally to federal grants that come out for specific purposes, as we talked about at the beginning. There are many cost drivers. Demographic changes, as has already been talked about, including employment and education opportunities, The degree to which substance abuse is prevalent, particularly when there are new and enhanced street drugs, and I think it's, you know, we're talking a lot these days about methamphetamine. This has been an ongoing problem, frankly, in Oregon for more than 10 years. We were one of the first states that was impacted. I'm glad and sorry at the same time that it's taken us this long to give more focused attention to that, but we're seeing a lot of additional difficulties as a result of methamphetamine in this state. But I also want to emphasize that the primary drug of abuse is still alcohol. And we need not to get so preoccupied with methamphetamines that we forget about the thing that drives us most. Other cost drivers include federal and state mandates. I'll take a moment just to mention that we have a settlement agreement in the state hospital for civilly committed adults under the Miranda B lawsuit, which is in Olmstead, a Supreme Court decision called Olmstead, which really has required us to focus more, and I think this is not at all a bad thing, but has really required a greater focus on the discharge of civilly committed patients out of the state hospital. We also have federal and state court orders that we're in operating under with the state hospital, so that a major cost driver, frankly, at the state hospital right now is the increased number of people who have pled guilty except for insanity. We set a record this year of 126. The previous year was 110. The year before that was 78. And before that, it had been bouncing around the 60s and low 70s. So one of the cost drivers here is whatever is going on in terms of moving people more into the criminal commitment area. We're also seeing an increase in people who need to be evaluated and then treated until they're able to stand trial. So these are factors that are driving costs.
Sorry to interrupt, but Senator Winters, I know, has a question for you.
I don't want to diminish either one of the drugs, because you mentioned that's more prevalent with alcohol. Has there been any studies that would point to whether one drug is more, the behavior is more assaultive and more aggressive than the other one? Because what we hear about methamphetamine is how the person who is using that drug, how more combative and assaultive that they've become.
Madam Chair, Senator Winters, I think there's no doubt that the short-term acute effects of methamphetamine are probably more pronounced behaviorally. Not that you can't have those same kind of behaviors with someone who's intoxicated. I think the long-term effects are both are very, very profound. And so I think you're probably hearing correctly that short-term use of methamphetamine and cocaine can be, you know, extremely unsettling, and people can be very combative.
Before you continue, Senator Przanski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just would follow up on that. I'd say what we know about alcohol, though, is that it is prompt throughout the criminal justice system and assaults, domestic violence. We see that on a daily basis. Not saying that you don't have meth users having the same issues, but it seems on the scale of the number of people involved, at least the police reports I see, really focuses on the amount of individuals that are intoxicated with alcohol.
I didn't want to diminish either, but from what we've been hearing is that short-term, not only when you look at the abuse, that it appears to be a lot more prevalent for those short-term users on children, and I know that we've found more deaths for children who've been associated where there's been methamphetamine use lately. So I just wondered if there had been any studies that had been done.
Other cost drivers are community and family instability. I think one of the more astounding things that I heard just earlier is that I think I heard that 20% of the youth in Oregon Youth Authority facilities are already parents. I mean, that certainly leads to some concerns about how we're going to deal with those from a family perspective. And finally, the last area of cost drivers, although again this is not an exhaustive list, is the availability of health care. The ability for people to get earlier access to both mental health and addiction services is potentially one of the key cost drivers. The longer we wait, the bigger the problems are and the more the consequences are. Finally, just to list a few areas of discretion, the system always has to make decisions in a priority way about how promptly we're going to respond. For example, in a crisis situation in mental health, I had a call over the weekend from a friend of mine whose daughter-in-law is clearly having a psychotic episode. I referred them to the proper crisis resource. She was not threatening to commit suicide. She was not an immediate harm to her three-month-old baby. But those are the kind of tough questions that come up. At what point, when you have limited resources, do you allow situations to go on, or how soon do you intervene? Fortunately, in this situation, she started breaking windshields and endangered her three-month-old daughter, and so the system did respond, and I'm hoping that the system would have responded far earlier than that. But those, just as an example, those are the kind of decisions that crisis programs have to make every day of the year. We list here an area of discretion is not to respond at all. I think the kind of situations that brings forward is if a person is depressed but not really in an acute crisis, you know that things are going to get worse at some point. The response based on resource shortages may be no response at all until the situation gets much worse. And who responds is another choice. Unfortunately, when mental health resources are stretched too thin, we default into the law enforcement agency, not because we want to, but because that's just the reality. That's what happens when the system can't respond fast enough. Certainly, the legal system then has areas of discretion about whether to charge with a crime or try to divert to community treatment. I think, again, this is where drug courts, treatment courts, are really critical advances in our understanding about how we can work with people, even if they have entered the law enforcement system. Can we do something that really blends treatment into their process sooner than later? I think with that, I will turn it over to Craig and see if he'd like to make some additional remarks.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, only additional comments I wanted to make was to make clear the connection between, if you looked at the skit when Chris went to Heidi, was playing the probation officer, and she was working with Karen to get him treatment. I wanted to highlight that community corrections and the parole and probation officers, some of the interventions that they do in getting folks into, I think, what we think of treatment are things like home visits, UAs, I think you saw that, polygraph testing, recommending people go to day reporting centers, electronic monitoring. Because the skit had to be short, I don't want you to think that once a person is released from custody, that's it. There is intervention, and there is that parole or probation officer who's using those, and those are also meant to prevent crimes, prevent victimization. Then the bigger framework are what we, I think of more traditionally as those services, making sure there's a parole or probation officer there to make sure that the defendant is availing themselves of the services that I think when Max Williams was talking about, focused on the criminogenic factors, i.e. the substance abuse treatment, mental health treatment, anger managed treatment, what they call cognitive change programs. Obviously, sex offender treatment is one of the big ones, employment assistance, and education. Again, those are all things that community corrections officers are doing so that making sure that the treatment and the services that we have, all that are focused on reducing recidivism and reducing victimization, are used. And then finally, the other thing I wanted to highlight that in the skit you can't really highlight is the probation and parole officer also has the ability to use what they call administrative sanctions, so that before you have to go back to the judge, the parole or probation officer often will, we have a system just like we have the sentencing guidelines where there's a matrix of what jail or prison beds should be used. The parole and probation officer has that intervention ability to use jail or house arrest or community service or requiring a residential treatment or day centers and things, so that there is that interaction between the what I think of as the pure treatment services and the criminal justice system. It's a lot more interactive than the skit allowed us to show, and I just wanted to highlight that real briefly, and then we're available for any questions.
Thank you for your presentations. Questions or comments? Ms. Ray, would you preview the days ahead? And then I have a comment.
Chair Gordley and members of the committees, hopefully today we've set the stage for you on how all of the elements of the public safety system are interrelated. You met Chris today. You'll meet Chris's family tomorrow. We'll have another skit for you that illustrates the next segment that we'll be going into concerning the dependency justice system, that's child abuse and neglect. As we go through that system tomorrow, it is my hope that those very, very sobering statistics that OYA Director Bob Jester offered are fresh in your mind, because the OYA offender profile, and some of us have been around this system for some time, they continue to be startling. Even somebody that thinks that she's heard it all, those statistics, once again, I think just reinforce the need why, the need for the understanding deeply by all of you of the interrelationships of our system. And when we're talking about babies having babies, 19% of an OYA population already have children of their own. I think that tells us how tremendously hard we need to work together. So tomorrow we'll focus on the dependency justice system, and then we'll respond to some questions tomorrow and then get into day three on the further examples of the interrelationships. So with that, Madam Chair, we're done from our standpoint for today.
I have a couple of comments and challenges for you. After today's presentation and looking ahead, I'm concerned and want to make sure that we get some information, again, from looking at the big picture, that tells us what the challenges are around girls and females in our system. These have been underserved populations historically, traditionally. And then also, we have challenges around the overrepresentation of people of color in our system, whether it's the juvenile side or on the adult corrections side. I wouldn't want us to get past 3 days and not talk about these issues at all. So let's address them on day two and day three.
Chair Gordley, excellent points, and with your permission, we'll also make certain that we have folks here on Wednesday prepared to discuss with you the overrepresentation issues and the overrepresentation summits that have been co-sponsored in part by the governor and others. In addition, I'm certain that Bob Jester and Max Williams both can discuss efforts on girls and females in the correction system. We'll ask the folks tomorrow to be alert to that as we talk about the dependency side as well.
Very good. And Senator Krasanski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If you could also look at or give us presentations as to the impact or overrepresentation as it may be with mental health, as well as those individuals with dual diagnostics. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you. I think we've concluded our work for today, and our meeting is adjourned.